Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. Folks, news tonight, sort of breaking news, but news that I think we all fully expected. But the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation has confirmed that the bodies found in rural Texas County have been identified as missing Kansas moms, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly. I think we fully expected that, but now it's official. And that, of course, came from the Oklahoma Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. So they have been positively identified. And as I said, we fully expected this when they found these bodies. They found the bodies based on human information that they got and other and scientific information. And we're going to go into that because this investigation was unbelievable. I think, you know, from a police perspective, I'm looking back at it, I'm observing it. And Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, the Kansas Highway Patrol, the Texas Highway Patrol, the local police agency, they did an unbelievable job. But yet, so many shit stirrers out there, most of them from the press, some of them from YouTube, want to criticize the police because what, it didn't happen in 2 hours? Those are the people that don't understand investigation. Those are the people that really need to sit back and look, listen, and learn because it pisses me off. And a lot of these YouTubers are just as bad. You know, first of all, a content creator does not belong out in the field doing the work that the police do. If I ran into people like that when I was on the NYPD, I would have kicked them in the ass and sent them on their way. Because they're interfering with the investigation. And even if they find something out, are they doing it for clicks on YouTube? Or the police don't want their help, but everyone wants to criticize the police, criticize the FBI, because I guess 2 weeks wasn't fast enough, wasn't quick enough for you people. And this investigation is not over. We're finding out things right now. We're like, wow, this is unbelievable. And to think that there is just such evil people, and I've seen them. I've seen these evil people. But look at this, Tiffany Adams. She reminds me of Ma Barker, you know? And 54 years old, she looks about 90. And that's from meth. She's a meth head, you know? And her boyfriend, who's the friend of a local judge. Every minute, this story gets crazier. And Cole Earl Twombly and his wife. All of these people conspired to murder two mothers over a custody battle. And then we find out it gets better. They're a part of an organization called God's Misfits, an anti-government organization. Wow. This case was already crazy enough without that, but we got that. So folks, hold on to your seats. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective, and you're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off-the-cuff zone.
There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10th and Grant's bike rider.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
You know, I want to get right into this with my co-host because I have super co-host tonight. And in fact, Bobby Chacon from the West Coast, I call him usually about a half hour before the show. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm just getting out of the gym. And he always makes it. I'm like, Bobby, you're great, you know. So that's the way I roll. And, you know, I guess the guys that roll with me roll the same way. So with us, retired NYPD sergeant, professor at Albertus Magnus College in Connecticut, attorney, welcome to the show, Professor Mike Geary.
Hey, Bill, good evening. Thank you for having me on. Welcome, everyone.
It's great. And from the West Coast or the Left Coast, whatever you want to say, but former FBI agent, scuba diver, attorney, jack of all trades, former writer for the show Criminal Minds, Bobby Chacon, welcome to the show.
Hey, boss. Thanks for having me.
Robbie, I hope you got a good pump at the gym, you know, because the women that watch my show like to see you coming in with, oh, your New York Giants shirt and all of that.
Yeah. I'm representing the Giants. I'm a lifelong Giant fan.
Great to see you. Anyway, this whole case is unbelievable. As you heard in my opening monologue, it's no longer a mystery. We know for sure they've identified these two ladies. May they rest in peace, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly. And, you know, some of the things we're finding out now are just so baffling. And I guess maybe not so baffling in rural Oklahoma, maybe, where these people live. But it seems when you look at these folks on the screen, they're pretty scary. I mean, and grandma is 54 years old. And as I said, she looks like she could be 84, you know, and you don't get that way through clean living. You don't get that way through going to the gym every day and eating yogurt and that kind of stuff. It seems like there's some drug abuse here. And, you know, everyone in this community that's questioned seems to be terrified of these people. And that's one of the reasons I think that no one early on wanted to cooperate. Now, Bobby, I'm going to direct this at you. Now we find out they're in this anti-government group called God's Misfits. But yet, I don't think they were on the FBI's screen. You know, and that's not unusual because, look, there's gangs across every city in this country that are a gang, but no one knows about them. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, yeah, they're misfits, no doubt. So I think the term fits, I don't know about God's misfits, but they look like a bunch of misfits. So, like, for the FBI to kind of pay attention to all these different white trash tweaker groups that are out there doing whatever. I mean, if they're committing crimes, that's one thing. But I don't think that this group was any criminal mastermind, as evidenced by the quick arrests in this case, right? These men and women were not out there causing a lot of havoc and undermining the government. They looked like low information people. Yeah, look at them. I mean, it's just, I hate to judge anybody on their appearance, but I will judge these people on their appearance. And I can tell you that until they're found guilty by, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt in court, they're presumed innocent. But with the speed of the investigation and what we're hearing as far as a witness, you know, it's pretty clear what happened here. The minute I heard there was a nasty custody battle going on, I go, whoa, there you go. I mean, it's the same thing when you get every time you hear these custody battles, these vicious custody battles in relation to a missing wife or a missing husband or, you know, it's right there in front of you. And I wonder, when I first heard about these arrests, I wonder, like, you look at these four and they're getting together and obviously it was premeditated, it was planned, they diverted the car down a certain road. Like, when you're doing this planning, when they're sitting around their double wide and they're planning this out, like, how do you think you're going to get away with it? Like, you know, the police, the husband's always the first suspect, right? Well, in a custody battle, the family is going to be the first, you know, the family on, you know, what looks to be the losing side, or who feels they might be losing, is going to be looked at. You're going to be the principal suspects. How do you think you're going to get away with something like this? It just baffles me.
You know, Bobby, and I'm going to direct this to you right away. Early on in the investigation, we said, right, let's do the victimology. Let's find out who Veronica Butler is. And right away, what pops up is what Bobby just said.
Right.
The custody battle. That must be the reason that this happened. That must be the reason that, you know, this violence occurred. Your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, Billy, this goes back, this custody battle goes back to 2017 and involves Rickman, the husband or the boyfriend, and the family, the Adams family. Now, there was, and we talked about this the other day, Ms. Butler had just recently asked for a new court date, April 17th. There was going to be a new court date for Butler to challenge the present visitation setup. And I opine that I think that might have actually been the moment that they said, we got to do something. Whatever that court was, whenever they filed those papers and the judge gave them a date of April 17th, I think from that point on, her, she was, you know, they had signed her own death warrant and they were planning to take her down. It was other sorts of things that they wanted to do, like, for instance, drop an anvil through her.
That's unbelievable to me.
Yeah. Like, and so I think that's where it happened. And we said it, and thank you, Bobby, for saying the same thing. We said the same thing. I mean, evil is so predictable in certain situations. And this is, you don't need to have, Sherlock Holmes on your side to say, okay, this sounds like something we've heard many times before. There are people out there who think nobody will ever figure out a motive, how this happened. We can do this. We can put our little brains together and do this and trip up all the homicide investigators in the state of Oklahoma. That's crazy. And look at the evil that they visited upon the Butler and Kelly family.
Well, that's because they are God's misfits. I want to play a little bit of News Nation, who did a great job reporting on this. Let me play a little of this.
The area, who says he's a friend of Tad Cullum's. Brian Enten joins us now live from Elkhart, Kansas. Brian, what did he tell you?
Yeah, Elizabeth, this judge is in shock, just like everyone else. He says that he has seen suspect Tad Cullum almost every single day for the last couple of weeks because they're in business together, they're friends. He was even at Tad Cullum's house when the raid went down, when the SWAT team showed up. So he's in disbelief, says that no one around here can believe that any of this has happened. And I also asked him about that cult group, God's Misfits, what he knows about that. Take a listen.
The way I understand it is they got God behind them and they make their own laws. But now, again, that's hearsay. I never knew about them.
That's what you're hearing from other people in town.
That's what I'm hearing from other people. Yeah. I'll say it again. I'm blown away that this even happened. I just can't. Tad was a very good friend of mine. I'm not going to say was a very good friend of mine. He is a good friend of mine. But this just blew me away.
And it.
This guy's a judge. Where is the judgment in this judge that this guy, Tad, is his friend? And Tad's arrested for first degree murder. He does things in this case that facilitate this murder. And this judge is saying he's still my friend. Judge, you better retire. You better leave your seat because. Look, on the police department, we had things that if you associated with known criminals, you could lose your job.
Yeah, and you know, that guy, I mean, when you were talking about the woman looking like she was much older, I mean, when you just showed that picture of him, that guy's 43 years old in that picture? The guy with the long beard, it looks like he's 83. He looks even older than the female, and he's younger than her. He looks like he's 83.
Yeah, that's why there he is. We
that's
said
43.
Yeah, we said he was ZZ Top's bass player, you know. But I know we're being a little bit cavalier about describing people the book by its cover, but you know, it's more than their descriptions. They did things, and we know through this investigation that they did things that put them all in the trick bag here. You know, some of the things like buying burner phones. Mm-hmm. She bought Tiffany Adams, who's the grandmother, the one who's 54 and looks 94. She bought 5 burner phones, believing that, oh, that's the way I've read this in some novel. And what I'm amazed at, Bobby, and you probably know more about this than me because I've been off the job longer than you. I was thinking they may not have great success in triangulating these phones because this is such a rural area and there's not as many cell towers, not as many cell sites, but it's unbelievable. They picked up everything and they put them at the location where the car was with these phones. And where's the towers? That geofencing. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but obviously the FBI has tremendous equipment to do that.
Yeah, sometimes in those rural areas, it's actually easier because there are less cell sites. So you're going to be hitting on, you know, one or two or three. Whereas in a big city, you could be bouncing off many as you're traveling through. So, But I'm not even sure it's going to come down. This case is going to come down to this. It sounds like they found a couple of pools of blood, you know, that they kept under their hats at the crime scene where the car was found. We didn't know that until, you know, recently. I think there's a good deal of physical evidence, and married that with a witness that's going to tell the narrative of this story. I don't know. I was just a juror last year on a murder one trial, and we had to deal with a lot of cell phone data. It was a 5-month trial. I was on trial for 5 months. Wow. And I was a juror, and it went forever. We had all kinds of cell phones, tower testimony and stuff. I don't think this case is going to be made that way. I think this case is, they've got one main witness that tells the narrative, and that narrative is going to be supported by the physical evidence in this case. This is the fact that they bought those burn-up phones goes way down the road of premeditation. I mean, this is going to be an easy case, I think, to prove premeditation. And I don't know if Oklahoma even has the death penalty, but certainly
they actually do. Yep. They do have the death penalty.
Certainly that premeditation is there. If there's ever a case where people should face the death penalty, it's a case like this. There's so much premeditation here. You've got, you know, a victim that didn't even have anything to do with this case other than they were kind of a supervisor of the custodial visits. I mean, these people are so cold-blooded that they wouldn't even mind taking the life of somebody that's completely disconnected to their family and to this controversy. Collateral damage, if you will. And anyone that cold-hearted, I mean, should face the death penalty.
100%. You know, an interesting thing, and talk about premeditation in this, a woman named Cheryl Bruin, she was the custody supervisor, and she was told by Miss Adams, take off a few weeks, because she knew she was planning to kill whoever was with her, Veronica, and was Jillian Kelly, who was like a substitute person that supervised the visit.
Wow.
And they had no problem killing her.
Wow. That's the first time I'm hearing. That's outrageous. Yeah.
Talk about premeditation. She had no problem killing this woman, this innocent woman. Well, besides Veronica Butler, Jillian Kelly was a mother of 4 children. She was the wife of a preacher. And I guess this was her job to do this. And they had, and you know, some of the things we're finding out now, we talk about manner and cause of death. And the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, them and the FBI did a fantastic job zipping it, keeping their mouth shut. And I know the FBI always keeps their mouth shut. And I think that's a great policy. Because you're not going to lose a case because the press destroyed your witnesses, you know? And people don't understand that. That's why so many of these YouTubers that go out into the field, they're really causing havoc. They're causing a shitstorm for the criminal justice system. And that's why no one talks to the press. And, you know, I don't want to get into it, but New York City Police Department had a policy of being way more open with the press than they should have been. They gave the press everything that they wanted, and to the detriment of cases sometimes.
And, yeah, I've been asked that question a ton of times. And during my time doing investigations, my whole approach was, you know, there's only 2 instances, and I get a lot of grief from the true crime community on this. And I echo your statements in your opening. I got a lot of grief during the Idaho early weeks of the Idaho case because I was going about for the police. I'd say, you remember the family of one of the Idaho victims was coming out and saying the Teresa, it's too slow. I said, this is a quadruple homicide with a very complicated crime scene. This is not an easy case to make. And when they arrested Koberger, I said, this is a lightning fast arrest. They did amazing work. But prior to the arrest, I was pushing back on all of the criticism of the police in that case. I said, these are complicated cases, and you get one crack. And once you file charges, the defendant has a right to a speedy trial. So the prosecutor has to feel day one those charges are filed that they can go into court as soon as possible because the defense can force that. And get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So you know, these are complicated cases, like you said, and people shouldn't be clamoring out there. I've seen true crime celebrities out there going to crime scenes and trying to interview witnesses for their podcasts and for their YouTube shows and stuff. And I'm with you. I had the same type of situation when I was on a job. Once I had a crime scene. It was over in Jersey on the river. I was there with my dive team, and I had to threaten a guy who showed up with arrest for interference with governmental administration, obstruction of justice, what they used to call it, because he kept coming into my crime scene and with a camera. And he was then going around and talking to the family saying, those guys don't know what they're doing. You should hire me and my team, all private searchers. We're a charity. You can donate to our charity and we'll go in and we'll find what they're looking for. And it was really a problem. And I threatened to have him arrested unless he got the heck out of my scene. And so I see some of that clamor now with these podcasters and these content creators and these YouTubers running out, running the minute something happens. I saw that rape murder in Georgia at the University of Georgia, people running down there and even putting on Instagram, we're on scene and we're interviewing witnesses so that they get clicks and they get followers and they get, you know, people to view their videos. It's a problem.
You know, Bobby, it's so true. And they don't realize the damage they're doing and they
don't care.
They don't care. They don't care. And that's disturbing to me because I've done this work. You've done this work. And I had a disdain for the press when I was on the police department. They used to actually try to interview the witnesses before we even got to them. Like, who are you? Get out of here. You know, like, so we had to threaten them.
I got off the topic, but the two times that I would be in favor of releasing information, right? Only two times. One was where it was a legitimate public safety concern, where the members of the public would legitimately be safer. Now, that's when I say legitimate, because the press always says, you know, oh, it's public safety, you know, but it has to be a legitimate reason that the public would be safer if we put this information out there. That's one. The second one is if it had a strategic advantage to my investigation. In other words, if I release this piece of information and I'm watching somebody to see how they're going to behave if once that information goes public, something like that, if there was a strategic benefit to my investigation, those are the only two instances in which I ever favored releasing information to the public, the press, even the family of potential victims, because you and I, we all know that sometimes your victims come from the same family. I mean, your suspects come from the same family as the victims. So I always was careful with how I approach the family and talk to family members as well, because you never know.
Absolutely. You know, some of the new things we found out too, and we talked about early on, they didn't come out with a manner of death and a cause of death. Now, the manner of death, they really came out real early because these people were arrested for murder, but they said, oh, it hasn't decided yet. It was, of course it was. They're arrested. They're under arrest for murder. Anyway, the other thing is, on the scene, they found by Veronica Butler's, her glasses, a hammer, which leads me to believe she died from blunt trauma. And then Jillian Kelly, they found a magazine inside her purse, but no gun. So supposedly she carried a gun. My question was, did they disarm her or did they shoot her? Because initially it came out that the cause of death was a shooting. And I had spoken about, and Mike had spoken about, well, potentially inside the car, there could have been high velocity blood spatter and maybe ballistics inside the car. But finding a hammer on the scene leads me to believe that this was up close and personal, which it was. And potentially Veronica Butler was beaten to death. Mike, your thoughts?
Yeah, Billy, early on, probably within several minutes when the car was found by the Oklahoma, that county police, and they called the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, and they were great. They did a great job. They preserved that scene. The first officers, uniformed officers on the scene, they preserved it, got the OSBI there. The OSBI realized with the blood maybe inside the car, blood outside the car, the broken glasses, the hammer, they classified it as, you know, a homicide immediately. And so therefore everything was preserved really well. They did a great job and there was a really fantastic cooperation. They were so tight-lipped and that was frustrating, but you know, we've seen this in the Koberger case and how successful this can be. And even like the Gilgo Beach killing and that they did a great job. So if anyone was frustrated, you know, that's okay. As we talked about, you and I talked about the other day, when would you release information to the press? And Bobby said, you know, exact thing. That's when you do it. As you were talking, Bobby, I was looking at some notes, and I saw even one more piece of evidence that would show premeditation is besides the burner phones, Ms. Adams also bought like three stun guns. Just like a week before the missing, the deaths. So therefore, I mean, you just want to pile on little bits of information, all circumstantial evidence, you know, all showing premeditation. This wasn't an act of, instant sort of temporary insanity where somebody's passions are inflamed and, you know, somebody strikes you and you strike back. No, this was cold-hearted, cold-blooded, premeditation, probably at least several weeks before the day that they did it. Really, really sad.
You know, Mike and Bobby, at 9:42 on the day they went missing, which I believe was the 30th of March, Miss Adams had made a phone call from her house to Veronica, and that was the last interaction they had. Now, of course, she was smart enough to leave her real cell phone at home, and now the burner phones were on the scene. So to me, that kind of technology is outstanding, and that's got to be the FBI's involvement.
Yeah, the FBI has special teams now that we, you know, that these guys, these men and women, that's all they do is cell phones. They become such experts in cell phones. And, you know, every time a new version of a cell phone comes out, be it a Google phone or whatever, they have different, you know, encryption, and they have different safety features and stuff. And then, so they have to go to work to how to defeat that and how to keep track of that stuff. And so it's an ongoing battle all the time, but it's really important because you can see how it makes cases, and nobody can, none of us can live without our phones anymore, even the criminals, you know? And so like, you know, they try to leave their phones at home or, you know, there was a case where it might've been Idaho where like, you know, he shut his phone off so it wouldn't attract, but the gap where his phone is off speaks volumes, you know, because it's here, and then it's off, and then it's over here, and it's like that gap hurts you even more than if you had left it on, because now it's obvious you didn't want your phone from point A, we know, to point B, it reappeared. You know, that gap is really telling. So they can try to be clever about it, but often technology is going to win the day, And as they try to hide things, it's not going to work.
You know, the son of Miss Adams, Tiffany Adams, her and her boyfriend, these two challenged individuals, Tad Burt Cullum, they have court records of them threatening to kill her son, who is the baby's father. The children in this case are a 6-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son. And as Mike said earlier, this went back to 2019, but they have on record. So this guy, Tad Cullum, who this judge is proud to call his friend, had a record in a court record, a family that he and Tiffany Adams threatened to murder the baby's dad. So it's like, and this judge, that's like baffling to me. This guy's going on national television. We're still friends. Like, dude, are you out of your mind?
Yeah, he's shocked. That amazes me because I didn't know that. I'm missing a lot of some of the facts because I've been busy with other cases. But like, how is he shocked that his friend was involved when his friend's on record, you know, in the court where he presumably sits as a judge, if not on that case, but in that same courthouse probably, you know, how could he be surprised if his friend is already engaged in threatening behavior, you know, terroristic behavior? It's baffling. You're right. That guy probably should consider a vocational change because, you know, the very term judge,
cows or something, I don't know,
insinuates that you have some level of judgment. You can judge people. Like, you see this guy and you should have some instinct, you know, that says that's not a good dude. And he clearly misses that talent. But you mentioned, so the first thing I was thinking about, I'll play the audience here, is that, you know, as soon as I heard custody battle, of course we all thought, okay, that's what it's about. But then my immediate next jump was the biological father. It's got to be the guy who wants custody of the kid, because that's what I always assume. It's the biological mother against the biological father, you know. And if one of them winds up dead, you look at the other one. And so it's bizarre in this case. So when I heard the arrest, I automatically assumed the biological father was going to be one of the ones in custody. But is there no...
You know, Bobby, I thought the same way. I think initially I thought this is going to be the father that killed the baby's mother, because they're not married. That's a term we use. But it turns out that the witness, and you always pray for a good witness, and that's part of the victimology, but the witness happens to be the 16-year-old daughter of Cole Earl Twombly and Cora Twombly. So their daughter, they came home after the dirty deed was done, and they asked her to clean out the Chevy. Right. Something went terribly wrong with Veronica, but you'll never see Veronica again. And she said, well, what about the other lady, Kelly? She goes, well, she was too friendly with Veronica, so she had to go too. Something of that matter. That's not a perfect quote. And then she says, well, where are their bodies? Down a well? She goes, something like that. So there's like premeditation that these two, and God's misfits? My God. Yeah. You're
having such what seemingly casual conversation with a 16-year-old about murdering two people in cold blood is amazing. And clearly, when I heard, I think the bodies were found about 8 miles from where their vehicle was found.
Yes.
They were transported probably in that car. So there's probably physical forensic evidence in that car, no matter how good a job the 16-year-old did of cleaning it up. Hopefully the authorities have gotten those vehicles now and done a forensic examination of the inside of those vehicles, which would, you know, tie them to the deaths and tie them to the vehicle, obviously, if it's their vehicle. So yeah, it's amazing. And you know, just like the roommate in Idaho deserves all the credit, this 16-year-old girl deserves all the credit in the world for being brave enough to step forward and say, you know, this is just not right.
You know, what we had thought earlier on before we knew all of this stuff, when they released the probable cause affidavit, was we were thinking that one of these four outstanding citizens was going to flip. And like, who was the weak link? And right away, Professor Mike picked out Cora Twombly.
Yeah.
She's going to flip because she's, you know, she'll be the weak link. Now it turns out maybe none of them. It's their daughter that told the police. Well, the daughter even knew about the burner phone. She goes, oh, yeah, my mom and dad were walking around with these new phones. They were charging them on their nightstand. I'm like, oh, my God.
Billy, I lost. I bet you a paycheck that and I lost a paycheck on that prediction of mine. Thank goodness for that 16-year-old. And I'm glad I lost my paycheck, because could you just imagine the dynamics within that family? When I was 16, I could not imagine my father and mother telling me, oh, yeah, don't worry about the next door neighbor or the bully in school. We took care of it for you, kid. By the way, clean the blood out in the back of the car. Like, you know, what planet do these people, you know, live on? It's just remarkable that this sort of stuff goes on. And the idea, as you said, Bobby, that it was said so casually without and spontaneously to a daughter, your own child, it really then goes to the mindset, the cold-blooded, premeditated mindset, and that there's no passion or, you know, anything like that involved. This was nothing but a plan they had executed, and they had nothing against this lady at all themselves, the Twombly's, they had nothing against these poor ladies, and yet they managed to do this and talk about it in a manner that's very cavaliering and casual. That shocks the conscience. That really does. That will not go over well.
You're 100% right. It's like me saying, Bobby and Mike, what are you doing tonight? I gotta kill somebody.
Right.
Here's the burner phone. Here you got one. You know.
Right.
Just wear dark clothing and maybe, you know, have some sunglasses and stuff. Like, what? Like, when you think of this, well, God's misfits. Yeah, they're misfits, absolutely. But what made them think they could get away with this? And then the thing about the anvil, It reminds me of the coyote, you know, the thing that yeah, they wanted to throw an anvil through her windshield. Where did that come from?
Yeah, and I don't think that all four of them are going to wind up going to trial. I think that some of them will cave. One or more of them will cave. You know, will be looking at, hopefully looking at the death penalty or certainly life without parole, and will make a deal on the others. And who knows, maybe I think at least one, maybe more, will wind up folding.
That's a good point, because if you get one of them to fold, they can discuss everything that went on in the planning and the execution, whereas the daughter can only talk about what was said spontaneously later on. So that would be excellent, Bobby, if one of them folded, gave the jury a bird's eye view, a right involved, right in the middle of the conspiracy. That would be fantastic.
And, you know, I mean, we've all done it, right? So you have four people. I'm sure they've looked at every one of them really hard and say, all right, who should we go after first? Who should we lean on first? Let's get them in the room. And what's their weakness? You know, do they have children they want to see again or whatever? You know, I hate to say it, but you exploit people. You know, we exploit their weaknesses and we get them to make a deal. And so I'm sure they've assessed each of these four. They probably know their culpability. You know, who was the ringleader? Who was the follower? They probably know all of that by now. And they know a lot about each of these four people. And they know their weaknesses and who to go after first and who to try to make a deal with first based on their vulnerabilities and based on their culpability. And so they're assessing all that with the prosecutors and say, okay, this is the one we want in that room now. Let's go hard on them first. If we can't break them, this is number two, this is number three. But I'm sure that assessment has been made.
Right. 100%. I want to play, this is Mary Ellen O'Toole, and she made this prediction, or, you know, and this is why I like people that know about investigation. I hear a lot of these YouTubers, and they're just in la-la land with some of the stuff they report, but this is, she's a professor of criminal justice, PhD, and a former FBI agent.
Ellen O'Toole, retired FBI special agent. Now bring in Mary Ellen O'Toole, retired FBI special agent and director of the forensic sciences program at George Mason University. Mary Ellen, thanks for joining me this morning. Talk about a weekend. I mean, in just a couple of days, you had four arrests and the discovery of what will likely be the bodies of the two moms. We're expecting that press conference today from OSBI. As a retired FBI agent yourself, what are you expecting to come of that later today?
What I would be expecting at this point, short of any additional information in the next couple of hours, is that they will have identified the two bodies that they found. They will provide the cause of death. To me, it was really interesting that they already established the manner of death, homicide, before they even found the two bodies. So they must have a lot of forensic evidence there that allowed them to reach that conclusion. But I would expect that they will finalize that. They may amend the charges as well. Those are very serious charges to be filed preliminarily. So we'll see whether or not they will amend those charges based on what they've learned happened at that crime scene.
Yeah, and you bring me to my next question with the charges and the evidence. The suspects were all charged with a couple counts of first-degree murder, kidnapping, conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree. Just based on hearing that, what would evidence have to look like, Mary Ellen, for investigators to bring those charges against them and take them into custody?
Such a great question. It would have to be pretty significant. It would have to be information that came from probably several sources. One of them would be the forensics. That would be very important. And it sounds like they were able to determine a lot from the vehicle. So the forensic evidence is going to be very important and very critical. But secondly, they probably had human source information. And by that, I mean, when you have four people who possibly couldn't be involved in something like this, especially something where you're looking at the severest of charges, it's not unlikely that somebody talked in order to even reduce their charges, or that somebody told somebody else and it ends up on Facebook. So I think they probably had that information as well, so they could put the two together. But it looks like authorities were absolutely confident that they got it right, again, before they even identified the two bodies.
Yeah, I'm curious what these four are saying just behind the scenes here.
So I think she predicted that, you know, obviously she's experienced, and that's who I like to hear from on YouTube, because so many times you have people go just inventing shit and it drives me crazy, you know. And for example, you know, and there was someone in the chat right now who sent me an email, and I really appreciate her. If I can find her, I don't know if she wants to be identified. Lisa Nia, Pastor Granny and her bad BF Tad both had money and don't need more. Who knows what they did to make it? I'm sure doing bad there too. What she was speaking about was this area, the whole people talking about this case. You know, you spoke about Idaho, and 6 weeks people were freaking out. Is this a cold case? Should we bring in the National Guard? Should we bring in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines? You know, and people like you and me would say, shut up. Just shut up, News Nation. Shut up, Channel 4, NBC, ABC. Just shut your mouth. You don't know what you're talking about. Same thing here. 2 weeks. Oh, the police don't know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. Investigation takes time. Getting cell phone work doesn't happen like, boom, we want it. Get it. You know, the warrant. We want a warrant. Judge, sign it now. No. You got to write up the paperwork, present it to a judge, articulate why you need it, that you have probable cause. People don't understand this. They just think the magic wand, warrant, you got the warrant, magic wand, we want the cell phone records, we want the cell site information, we want the geofencing. They think it just click, boom, it happens. Bobby.
And I you know, we were all on one side of the team, and I always try to relate this to people. Like, we probably on the law enforcement side reach the point where we think arrests should be made before the prosecutors feel comfortable lodging charges, because they're the ones that have to get their butts up in court and get a conviction, right? So, you know, I've been in many times where I'm like, we have enough, let's go, we have enough, let's go. And the prosecutors, no, I want more, I want more, I want more. And it's always a little bit of a push and pull there. And I understand, you know, we respect each other immensely, the prosecution side, the law enforcement side. You know, oftentimes the police are ready to go and the prosecutors want a little more. They're waiting on one more lab report, or they're waiting on one more expert opinion, because they're the ones that have to get the conviction, and it's egg on their face in court if they get acquittals. So, you know, it just because nothing has happened doesn't mean they're not close to an arrest, or the police are at the point where they think they can make an arrest. But again, an arrest, the threshold to make an arrest is different than the threshold to get a conviction. And the day you make an arrest, the prosecutors often want to be comfortable enough that that day they can get a conviction because of speedy trial rules and stuff. And so, you know, people have to understand that the police have to, they're getting all the evidence, they're analyzing it, but they're also working with a prosecutor, you know, who is looking at it from a bit of a different viewpoint, a different perspective than us on this side of it look at it. They're thinking courtroom, they're thinking, you know, suppression hearings, they're thinking the whole big picture down the road. And I think sometimes the public doesn't appreciate that dynamic that's happening.
100%. And I think it's also the nature of human beings with this instant gratification world we live in, you know? I mean, you know, you want directions, you don't go ask Charlie on the corner, you just go put your GPS on, right? I mean, I was always getting lost. Before GPS, I was lost in the everywhere.
And kids, now kids don't understand the old jokes about the man not wanting to ever ask directions. You know, you stop, you see somebody outside the road, you roll down your window and you ask directions. Kids have no clue about that. Like, why would you do that? Like, they don't have any. That's the way we used to do it if you didn't have a, you know.
Well, now you teach kids if some adult approaches in one's direction, he's a pedophile.
Yeah, you know? Speed off.
Get away from that guy, you know?
Yeah.
Now we have GPS. I want to play a little bit of this. This is Brian Enten. They show a little about where, not directly, but close to where they found the bodies.
Butler and Jillian Kelly, who were last seen March 30th, investigators recovered two bodies in the area over the weekend. And while they have not yet been positively identified, four people are now charged in connection to the disappearances, and we're finally learning some more about them and their pasts. News Nation senior national correspondent Brian Enten now live there in Oklahoma. Brian, obviously this case continues to unfold, to develop. What is the latest there as of right now?
There's been shocking developments, it seems like, every day, Nicole. Sorry to join you from the car. We've been racing around, chasing different leads, going back and forth between Kansas and Oklahoma. All of this happening really right on the border between the two states. I want to show you, though, we have some new video, this right here. This is video from one of the properties.
That's the trailer belonging to Tad Cullum, who's the judge's friend. That is perhaps the vehicle in which they transported the bodies in. And the judge is still friends with them. That's, you know, they're all buddies. They're all drinking buddies.
Connected to one of the suspects. His name is Tad Cullum. He's the boyfriend of Grandma Tiffany Adams, who's sort of been at the center of this whole thing. We were over at that property. There were a number of police officers there, and they actually towed, you can see right there, they were towing a white trailer. There is something significant about that trailer, we are told, and that is the reason police wanted to take it into evidence. And what's interesting, Nicole, is we have heard from witnesses that they saw that white trailer in the area of where the two moms were killed. So it is possible that that is the trailer that was used to transport the bodies. That is obviously something police are investigating right now. Again, it's been a wild couple of days as this has come together. Grandma Tiffany Adams had been planning to kill the mother of her grandchildren. According to the affidavit, there was this very, very contentious custody dispute that had been ongoing. That seems to be at the center of this whole thing. We've learned that there was a previous attempt and plan to actually kill the victims before. That's something that we continue to look into. All four of the suspects will be in court tomorrow. So hopefully we'll learn a little bit more, Nicole.
And there are so many layers to all of this, because as we can see on our screen at the bottom, they were God's Misfits group. This is a religious cult group. What can you tell us about it? Because the accused killers are allegedly part of this group.
Yeah, so this is apparently a very, very secretive group in this area. We did not know that this was part of the puzzle until the affidavits came out. And this is something that investigators discovered that all four of the suspects had in common. Again, the name of the group is God's Misfits. And we are told that it is an anti-government group that has a religious affiliation. They hold meetings in the area. And again, all four of the suspects, according to police, were a part of this group. Now, did it actually really have anything to do with the murders? That we don't know. Again, all indications are that the murders were really focused around this custody dispute. But now that we know that there's this anti-government group involved, God's Misfits, it's something that that we're going to continue to look into, Nicole.
Yeah, well, we know you will be getting
So, you know, it's an amazing thing, and just a little aside to this. The New York Times would have never, ever written a story about this. They could give a shit about something happening in Oklahoma. But because of this God's Misfits thing, they were all over it. Because, oh, this is a white supremacy group. Let's write a story on it, you know, because it fits our narrative. And
sure. I mean, they're going to get readers if they can say it's some cultish, religious, you know, because they're anti-religion. They're always going to, you know, go for that headline. But let me play audience more again to you guys, because you've got more information on this. Because the things that jump, it's two questions I want to ask you guys. One, the grandmother of the children, the 6 and 8 year old, number one, was she a party? Because sometimes grandparents can sue for custody. Was she a party to the custody battle? And number two, if not, either way, is the biological father under any suspicion? Or did they just take this on their own?
No, Bobby, the biological father is in rehab. He's obviously, he has a criminal history himself, but he was fighting against that's his mother. He wanted, the custody was for him, but the grandmother, who was his mother, had custody right now because he was in rehab.
Okay.
But the Veronica, the child's mother, the two children's mother, she was trying to get more visitation and ultimately maybe get custody. So
from the grandmother who currently
has. Yes, from the grandmother,
right.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Okay.
And that is where this whole, the contention and this whole thing came from, is that, you know, I don't know how the grandmother just thought she was now Ma Barker and she was going to just take out her, you know, her son's baby's mother, because they're not married. But And I know that we'll get criticized. I don't care. You could see she's got drugs written all over her face. Yeah. I saw a picture of her from like 4 or 5 years ago. She was actually a very pretty woman. She looked good. So she must have got hit with the meth head a couple of months ago or a couple of years ago. And Tad Burt Cullum, if she's a meth head, what do you think he is? He's good friends with a judge. I know that.
Well, it seems like she did such a good job of raising her son, who's currently in rehab, that she wanted to raise the grandchildren as well. So she must have a lot of confidence in her child raising abilities. Yeah. But so the custody battle was basically between the grandmother and the victim.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That but makes she also sense. Was, she also had threatened with her boyfriend, Tad, to kill her son. And that's on record in family court. So like, as you said, how does this judge that's good friends, not just good friends, we're in business together. How does he not know that? And how does he still show up on national television saying what good friends? I can't imagine Tad. Most people couldn't believe O.J. Simpson did what he did. And I know he was found innocent, but he was guilty as hell.
He was found not guilty. He right. wasn't found innocent.
Right. He was found not guilty. But
difference.
Yeah. In a civil trial, he was found guilty as all hell, And
I don't know why, but these custody battles do kind of spur this. I think a few years ago, I don't know if you guys know the Piketon massacre, where like one family wiped out a whole nother family. I think there were 6 or 8 members of a family killed in one night by 6 or 8 members of another family over one child, the custody battle of one child. It's a very famous case in true crime. They moved, the family that committed the murders actually moved to Alaska, thinking they got away with it. They moved back, I think it was Ohio. I saw a documentary on it. But it was like that one night they went to three or four different locations and killed 8 family members of the opposite family, just over one small child's, the custody of one small child. And so obviously it stirs emotions in certain types of people, but you wonder, like we started off saying, how do you think you're going to get away with it? You're in a contentious battle with another person. If that person winds up dead, you're suspect number one. I don't understand the mindset of, I get it trying to make it look like an accident. The anvil thing is out there. It's out there. But I understand the concept of it. I understand the concept of, hey, let's make it look like a mischievous accident from some teenagers throwing something off a bridge of an overpass. I get the concept. But this, what were you thinking? It's a rural area. There's not many people out there. There's not going to be many people. It's not going to be like a random person that gets shot in New York or San Francisco or something, or Chicago. I don't know. It baffles me on how they're planning this and thinking that they're actually going to get away with it.
This is right from the affidavit. Her son's last name was Rickman. Rickman's grandmother reported in February 2024, and I'm not talking about Miss Adams. That's his mother.
Right. The other grandmother.
Yes. Rickman told her that they didn't have to worry about the custody battle much longer because Adams had it under control. That Adams knew the path the judge walked to work and we'll take out Veronica at drop-off. She actually said that. So it's like this lady thought she was Ma Barker or something, Rickman was confirmed to be in rehab facility in Oklahoma City at the time of the disappearance. The children were in custody of Adams.
My one question would be, and this is, and believe me, I am not victim blaming. I am not casting aspersions on the victim. But my investigator thought is, why didn't the biological mother have custody of these kids and the grandmother have visitation? Why did the grandmother?
There was an allegation of, I'll say SA, and because YouTube doesn't like when you say the word.
Okay.
There was an allegation of that by the grandmother because she played the system like a violin.
Oh, okay.
And she knew what she was doing. So on April 1st, 2024, Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation agents obtained a search warrant for Adam's cell phone. Agents performed an extraction on the device. Information gained from the device included web searches for taser pain level, gunshots, prepaid cell phones, and how to get someone out of their house. Oh my God. How do you, the good humor is out front,
you're searching about burner phones on your own computer.
Right.
Right.
Or on your own phone. You know, it's like, right. Like, oh,
ironic.
It's like, you can't make that stuff up. If you're so concerned about, you know, covering your tracks, you don't conduct a search like that from your own computer or your own phone.
Right. This is the interesting thing of the witness. On April 3rd, 2024, Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation interviewed the daughter of Cora Twombly and Kobe White. The daughter stated she had overheard group conversations related to Butler not protecting her children from her brother. The daughter said she was told by Cora that Adams, Cullum, Cora Cole, and Paul Grice were involved in the deaths of Butler and Kelly. Paul Grice is a person that hasn't been arrested. So if he's involved, we don't know why he hasn't been arrested. She stated that Adams had provided burner phones to use so they could communicate without using their personal devices. She said she saw two burner phones charging on Cora's nightstand. Mastermind criminals. They're so smart, you know? And here's the daughter turning out to be the best witness for the prosecution. And again, they talk about them being in an anti-government group, you know, that the gods, what do they call themselves?
The Misfits.
The gods Misfits group. And again, no one knows about them. They haven't done anything that would raise them to the level of the FBI knowing about them, perhaps local law enforcement. And these small towns, everyone's friend. Look, one of the guys being charged with murder, one's friends with the judge.
Yeah. I mean, and there's no allegation that this group had anything to do with it, or these four people's membership in that group had anything to do with this murder, had anything to do with them motivated to do this murder. They were just part of a group. They were, you know,
right.
It's just like being on, you know, being part of any group. It sounds like a wacky out there group, but there's no connection between the murders in that group or these four people's membership in that group and these murders. I mean, it's pretty clear that these two people were engaged in embroiled in a pretty contentious custody battle, and that's the motivation. You wonder why their two friends would allow themselves to be enlisted in this. What emotional stakes did they have in this case where they're willing to kill, or at least take part in the conspiracy to kill? And by the way, every one of these four are as guilty as any of the other four. Because, you know, they don't have to be the one that pulled the trigger. They're all guilty of murder if the evidence right. supports that they're part of that conspiracy.
Right.
So what would possess two people that have no blood relation and no seemingly no emotional detachment to this child that's the subject of this custody battle to allow themselves to be enlisted in a scheme that's going to end their lives as they know it? So it's bizarre to me, you know. It's bizarre to me that people would commit murders like this, but it's even more bizarre to me that two people unconnected to the custody battle would allow themselves to be enlisted in this thing. What did they stand to gain out of this?
Right, exactly. You know? That's baffling. Folks, I got to go to a quick commercial. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right location. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, hit the like button, share us with your friends and your family. If you want to contribute to us financially, we have a Patreon with three different levels, which we give extra content to. And we also have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, five different levels. And we appreciate all our friends, our fans, our subscribers who support the Police Off the Cuff podcast to bring you true crime from a police perspective. Yeah, I mean, I'm so baffled by this. But the thing is, Bobby and Mike, this isn't over. This investigation is nowhere close to being over. And could more people be implicated? Absolutely. This guy Grice, where did that come from?
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, and also, you remember, we're talking about such a small area, small place. You know, wherever they got these burner phones, they probably already talked to the guy that sold them the burner phones, because there's not that many places to go to in such a rural area.
It was like a Walmart or something.
Yeah, I'm sure like they have video from that store of them buying those phones. They've got the receipts. Even if they paid cash, they probably kind of knew when, because it's not like buying burner phones in New York City, right? I mean, they're going to track that stuff down because there's just so many less places to do this kind of stuff in a rural area. So I'm sure they're going to have a lot of that stuff backing up. So again, it's not just one witness. It's probably more than one witness. We know about the one. It's probably more, and not more with relation to the murder, but more like, oh yeah, they bought this, or they bought that, or they were in here. I saw that horse trailer, you know, near the site of the murders, you know, those kind of things, all supported by the forensic and physical evidence, the blood around the car, the blood in the car, maybe that the young lady was cleaning, told to clean. All of that stuff is supporting the narrative that they're building for the prosecution ultimately before a grand jury or a jury. So I think you're going to have, it's hopefully you're going to have a fairly strong case here.
100% circumstantial evidence, but very strong circumstantial evidence. Thank God I have two attorneys here. They can explain all this shit. David Ray from the chat, no connection between their cult and the murder. Well, we didn't call it a cult. We called it God's Misfits. Right now it's at the level of club. The New York Times jumped all over it because they love writing stories, what they think is like white supremacy stories. I call bull crap on that. The cult founder is one of those charged. It's not a cult. You're calling it a cult. Disempowerment leads these psychopaths into power and its criminal results. They called them an anti-government group. You know, you could call the Bloods and the Crips an anti-government group too, but no one does, you know? So
I don't know enough about the group, but it doesn't seem to me like the group's charter or whatever their soapbox issues are related to this murder. I think that, I mean, I could be wrong, but it looks like this was a murder related to the child custody battle that this grandmother and this mother were embroiled in. And it, as an aside, they all happen to be members. Maybe that's how they enlisted them, through their friendship, through this group. Maybe that's how they enlisted them. You know, that's what I was wondering earlier. Maybe that's how they enlisted them, because they shared this group together. And so that was a common bond that they used to recruit them into this murder scheme. But I don't see the murder being motivated by this group. You know, I mean, you're getting a bit of that in the Delphi murder case of the two little girls across the bridge. If you know that case, there's a suspect now, and there's jailers that are part of some secretive group. I can't remember what they call it, but in the Delphi, Indiana murders of Abby and Libby, those two girls, there's certain cultish kind of accusations going on. I don't see that. This seems to be a clear motivation. The intent and the motivation of this murder seem to be that custody battle.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is more information from the daughter, and they don't name her, obviously, because she's 16 years old. She said Cole and Cora took a blue and gray Chevrolet pickup owned by them and a blue flatbed pickup owned by Clint Twombly when they left and returned in the same pickups. The daughter was told to clean the interior of the Chevrolet pickup. When the daughter asked what happened, she was told that things did not go as planned, but they would not have to worry about her, Butler, again. The daughter asked about Kelly and why she had to die, and was told by Cora that she wasn't innocent either, as she had supported Butler. Wow. I mean, when you talk about the conspiracy and the acting in concert, if there was any thought that the wife of Twombly, Cora Twombly, if she has any innocence or no involvement, that statement right there just puts her right into the trick bag, as they say, you know?
What jumps out at me there is like, if it didn't go as planned, what was the plan? And what didn't go as planned? You know what I mean? Maybe they just didn't kill him in the right place, or they didn't show up with her. You know, I don't know what obviously, if they're talking to one of these people and they cave, they'll know what the plan was and how they deviated from the plan. But I'm pretty sure the plan all along was to kill them. Maybe they didn't kill them at the place they wanted to or in the way they wanted to, but I'm pretty sure the plan all along, based on what we've seen and what's been reported, is that the plan all along was to kill them. I mean, what else were you going to do?
That's why they wanted the escort, the woman, Kelly. And not groom.
Right. Yeah. They didn't want her there because they didn't want to kill her.
Right. Exactly. So, but I mean, they were fine with killing the other one.
Right. Right. So, So I think that things didn't go as planned just simply means they weren't able to kill them in the original manner and way in which they were hoping to. But that's inconsequential to getting convicted for murder.
The daughter asked Cora if their bodies were put in a well, and Cora replied, something like that. The daughter also disclosed that other attempts to kill Butler occurred during February of 2024 in New Yucatan, Kansas, in which Adams, Cullum, Cole, Cora, and Grice, that's the name that came up again, went to Yucatan, but Butler did not leave her residence. The daughter said the plan was to throw an anvil through Butler's windshield while driving, make it look like an accident because anvils regularly fall off work vehicles. I've never seen that happen before. Documents reveal the OSBI investigation showed that Adams searched for gun shops on her cell phone. A search of local gun shops showed Adams buying 5 stun guns in Guymon on March 23rd. So all of this, again, circumstantial evidence, but pile circumstantial evidence on top, and it becomes tremendously powerful. Professor Mike.
Yeah, Billy, we've talked about this because, you know, until you get an eyewitness to break down and give actual testimony, you know, that would be direct evidence, or if you had a video of the actual execution taking place. But other than that, there's mostly circumstantial evidence, DNA evidence, fingerprint evidence, ballistic evidence, cell phone data, all of this stuff. But it, so long as it leads an ordinary, reasonably prudent juror to believe, based on using their common sense and life experience, and they put together some logical steps, that one piece of evidence, you know, allows them to conclude that something else happened. And so you pile this all on, and every once in a while you get people say, oh no, this is a really weak case. There's nothing but circumstantial evidence. Oh no, 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 no. Yeah? Oh yeah? Absolutely. Circumstantial evidence of the Koberger case. It's all circumstantial evidence. Look how amazingly powerful the evidence that they have again in that case is. So whenever people say, oh, there's no direct evidence, it's a weak case. No, 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 no. Circumstantial evidence could be even stronger because sometimes it doesn't involve a witness coming forward and saying, I actually saw something, and maybe their memory might be wrong. Maybe there's they have a motivation to give up someone with, you know, because maybe they were an eyewitness. But when you have cell phone data, it's accurate. DNA data, it's accurate. You know, GPS tracking on the cell phone is data. Search warrant for a cell phone. What was going on? What were they looking for on their laptop or on their cell phone? That is all absolutely 100% emotionless, you know, made by companies that, you know, bill people. So it's absolutely 100% accurate. They keep track of this. It can be the most damning evidence of all, circumstantial evidence.
Absolutely. And eyewitness testimony is often one of the more faulty pieces of evidence you can have and subject to cross-examination. A couple of years ago, we were at a crime con and my team did a presentation, and we set it up so that we were going to show an interrogation on stage. But really what it was an eyewitness exercise, but we didn't tell the audience that. We had like 300 people coming in as they were filtering in. And just as we were getting started, just before I was on stage with my partner, and just before we got started, we had staged a couple of distractions in the audience, a couple fighting and something like that. And then we had a loud bang, and we had people come in and abduct a young girl. She was part of it, of course. And they took her out. 4 people from different parts of the audience got together. One person came into the room and they took this girl out. We said, okay. And then we sealed the room and we said, okay, who saw what happened? And we took about a dozen or 2 dozen people into different rooms, and we spent an hour and everybody stayed in. And then we came back with the physical descriptions. You can't believe the variety of physical descriptions of people who saw what. Now, this is a well-lit room. There's no distractions. It's not nighttime. Everybody sees everybody. And, you know, we got, you know, the one person who came into the room, we got 5'4" to 6'2". We got black, we got white. We got a red sweater. We got a black t-shirt. So, like, these are the same people. And really, the audience was stunned by the fact that, you know, they just didn't see what they thought they saw and how many people saw different things of the same incident. So, and then a couple of years ago, I saw a stat where like 85% of the faulty convictions, not wrongful, but faulty convictions in California were based on, 85% were based on faulty eyewitness identification. So you're right, Professor Mike, the cell phone data, DNA, that's all scientific, that's all technological, that's solid. Right. A witness, an eyewitness, is not always the most solid, even though that's what everybody wants.
Right.
I mean, we've all seen the grainy, you know, the grainy bank robbery photos, you know, or videos, you know, a lot of times you can't tell from some of that stuff. But the DNA doesn't lie. The phone records, the cell towers don't lie. They have no motivation to lie. It's, you know, that stuff, although it's called circumstantial, sometimes is more impactful than an eyewitness.
You know, Bobby, I was always amazed because I did like 5 or 6 years as the RIP sergeant, 2.5 in the 2-4 and then 2 or 3 in the 2-3. And I was always amazed when someone could sit down at a computer and look at thousands of photos. And I would say, once they looked at X amount, their brain turns to mush and they'll never make an ID. Right. But sometimes it'd be like, well, just people would come in the 2-3 and, oh, I know that guy. I know this guy. And I just find that funny. And they were in the neighborhood, you know?
Oh, well, there's a very famous sketch of the Unabomber, of Ted Kaczynski with sunglasses and a hoodie on, right? That was a second sketch from an eyewitness 8 years after the fact, after they gave the first sketch. And then they tried to revive the case because it had gotten so old. And they went back and they got this sketch. It was the wrong sketch. The person, that very famous one with the glasses, mm-hmm. that face is actually the face of the first sketch artist. The witness had gotten it mixed up. And when she described it, she had spent so much time with the original sketch artist 8 years earlier, or however many years earlier it was, that when she gave that thing, we realized this later on, the FBI did, that the features in that very famous sketch that everybody sees now as the Unabomber is actually the face of the first sketch artist that she spent time with. And it was just a mix-up. Like you said, memories fade, they change. You look at a bunch of features, you know, those books, you know, those mug books, used to flip through. Everybody starts looking the same. And yeah, you can make those. That isn't always the best evidence, even though that's what else. Everybody's like, well, eyewitness, slam dunk. It's not always a slam dunk just because you have an eyewitness.
Absolutely. Let me just get through the rest of the affidavit. The OSBI investigation also showed that Adams bought 3 prepaid cell phones from Walmart and Guymon, according to the court documents. Search warrants for location services information on the phones were completed and revealed all 3 phones were at the area where Butler's car was located. That's pretty damn powerful evidence. The documents reveal all 3 phones were powered on and assessed for the first time at or near Cullum's home at different times before March 30th. I mean, just that right there, that shit takes time, you know, yeah. And all the people saying, oh, why didn't they solve it yet? Because that they didn't learn that in one day. They didn't learn it in 2 days. Before Butler and Kelly's disappearance on March 30th, before 10:16 a.m. and 10:35 p.m., court documents reveal that the phones pinged at a property about 8.5 miles away from the car. The documents state the property was below a dam in the pasture where fresh dirt work was located. Concrete was moved to or about 150 to 200 yards below the dam, where it was discovered that a hole had been dug and filled back and then covered with hay. I mean, what unbelievable work. I mean, outstanding work. But the science, the art and the science of investigation, and both of them are mixed in there to create the most powerful tool you have, the tool to create evidence that'll get a conviction of these 4 dirtbags that did this, you know?
Interesting you say there's that fifth person, that Grice. I think you said he may have been with them on the first attempt with the anvil or whatever, and there's 4 in custody. And did you say she bought 5 stun guns?
Well, here it's saying 3.
Oh, 3, okay.
Initially, I thought it said 5. But as you can see, the 16-year-old witness, the daughter of the Trombleys, she said she saw them charging on their dresser. Like,
well, I mean, why does somebody, you know, in a place where everybody has guns, why does somebody need 3 stun guns? I mean, 3. Why does one person need 3? That's one of those things. The audience is the jury is going to kind of ponder that and say why shortly before in this time frame when they're planning in the planning phases and they're obtaining the things to execute the plan, why would she buy 3 stun guns out of, you know, that's one of those, you know, like Professor Mike said, this is all piling on piece after piece after piece after piece.
Strong evidence, circumstantial evidences. But again, from the police perspective, we're giving this to our audience and to the YouTube audience. You know, Don't listen to people that say, oh, 2 weeks go by, the police and the FBI don't know what the hell they're doing, blah, 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 blah. And you know something? You can't say that when they bring in the top guns immediately. They bring in the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. They bring in the FBI. They have everyone and their brother working on this case. But yet 2 weeks was too long, you know. And look, if these two victims, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, are your family members, then any time is too much. But I think the family knew very early on that they were dead. I think.
Yeah. I mean, I was really surprised that too, because, you know, missing persons cases, usually they really go out of their way not to call it a homicide until, you know, they're sure. But in this case, they put that out that they believed they were deceased before they found the bodies. And that told me that they know something they're not releasing. And obviously, you know, we didn't know about the pools of blood, you know, at where the car was found, which is great. We didn't know about the blood possibly inside the car. You know, having all that information, you realize these people are probably deceased. But you know, we didn't know why they thought that, which is fine.
Right, exactly. Robin McCool, please don't forget the flying anvil theory. We were just talking about it. We love that theory. We love the Roadrunner. They must have been watching it too and came up with the anvil theory for making it all look like a freak accident. Love your show. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Patty Gee, Roxy, I agree they didn't expect Kelly to have a weapon. That's what went wrong. Kelly, Jillian Kelly is believed to have always carried a pistol on her. And they must have known that. They found a magazine in her purse, but not the gun. So
they probably either disarmed her or they took the weapon.
Right. And they shot her.
Yeah.
Or she was too slow to the draw. We don't know exactly what happened.
Right.
But that's why it sort of leaked out that this was a shooting. But I believe perhaps Veronica Butler, it may have been blunt trauma since they found a hammer in the road right near her glasses.
Probably why they had stun guns too, to incapacitate them if they knew. You know, they probably would have known that she had a weapon, that she carried a gun. I mean, they knew her very well. So I assume that the grandmother would have known that the mother carried a weapon. So they probably had to, you know, they probably were going to kind of get up close to her and stuff and then incapacitate her with the stun guns.
Well, you know, Bob, one thing I wanted to mention also, besides obviously this is a murder first degree, but what makes it the murder first degree is the underlying felony, which is kidnapping first degree. And a kidnapping first degree has a sentence almost, I think, as bad as murder, doesn't it?
I don't know the Oklahoma state laws, but I would imagine, you know, it could be a life term. I would imagine. I think that the murder does probably get you the death penalty, you know, which is what you want to charge them with if you're interested in flipping one of these four. You want to get the maximum penalty, get them to face the maximum penalty. So it's the, you know, the maximum motivation for them to make that deal.
100%. Crazy Italian lady, they transported them alive to another location, is my understanding. Crazy Italian lady, I don't know that for a fact. That could be, but all the information, a lot of misinformation comes out over YouTube that people just want to be first and report shit that they heard that has no basis in any truth. And I'm not saying what you just said can't be true. It might be true. It just hasn't been put out there by the authorities. This was posted on Facebook early on in the investigation by Jillian Kelly's mom. So they must have told the family. And if that, in fact, is her mom, and then she posted this, the grandma has confessed to killing both. And I haven't heard that either, but from any official source.
Right.
But, you know, the grandma, you know, we've been calling her Grandma Barker here. She seems to be the catalyst behind this whole thing. She seems to be the most culpable, the person that was the planner, the person that was the mover and shaker. She bought the guns. She bought the cell phones, and she was motivated to have this happen.
She was the one that benefits the most from the murders.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, why did the others agree to go along with this? Like, what was this? Was this just a, you know, an early morning walk in the park? I mean, why did they? That's hard to understand why they need to go along with this.
Knowing the penalties, you know, unless you're so convinced you're going to get away with it, which I don't know how you could be convinced of that. But if they convinced you that they were going to be able to get away with it, I guess that's why you do it. But you're not gaining anything. There's no, I mean, we don't know this, but they didn't, it doesn't, there's been no allegation that they offered to pay them to help or whatever. You know, maybe it was this common bond from this being in the same group that they wanted to help. And maybe, like you said, the grandmother convinced them that the children were in danger. And so they were motivated by this misguided notion of protecting the children. And maybe that's one of the motivations.
That could be. And in addition, Tiffany Adams and her boyfriend were considered sovereign citizens. I'd love that one. I would have loved to have pulled one of them over when I was a cop.
They considered themselves sovereign citizens.
Yeah, yeah. They, you know, they don't go by U.S. law. They don't go by Oklahoma law. I have my own laws. Oh, really?
Right.
Step out of the car. Put your hands behind your back. I'm going to show you what the law is, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, but you know a judge. He may vouch for you now. You know?
Send them where they follow Sharia law. Maybe they'll be better off.
Yeah, exactly. Let me play a little list from the local news.
In Texas County, Oklahoma, and reports back to us now on what he's learned. Max?
Yeah, and Lane, this shows you just how desolate this area is. We're here about 5 miles away from where that accident first took place. This is known as the Four Corners area. Now, Jillian Kelly, Veronica Butler were supposed to meet here at 10 a.m., but they did not make it there. Their vehicle was found about 5 miles north of where we're at right now. The signal is so bad out here that we actually had to move because we had SOS phone signal. Now, this affidavit has a lot to break down here, so stick with me on what we're taking away here. Now, Butler was in a custody battle with Tiffany Adams. Tiffany Adams is the grandmother of Butler's ex-husband, Wrangler Rickman. So they're in a custody battle, and Butler had a normal supervisor. She's preferred. Her name is Cheryl Brune. She was unavailable, so she contacted Kelly to do the supervising. That's what that relationship was developed. Brune later then said she was available to supervise, but Adams told her to take a couple weeks off. An interesting note there. Now, Butler told Adams, as we said, 10 a.m. they were going to meet right here. Police did not find the car here. They actually were contacted by family members after they found the car those 5 miles away, as we mentioned. They found evidence of severe injury, blood on the roadway, Butler's glasses in the roadway, a broken hammer, and a pistol magazine all found. That was found in Kelly's purse, but not the pistol itself. So clear evidence of a crime right off the bat. Now, OSBI interviewed the daughter of Cora Twombly. She's referred to as CW in this affidavit. Now, CW is 16 years old, said she believed Adams, Colin, Cole, and Paul Grice were involved in the deaths and that Adams had provided burner phones. CW said the group was involved in an anti-government group here in the area called God's Misfits. They actually had regular meetings at the Twombly's. Now, Cora and Cole came back from the day of the murder at 12 o'clock. This is 2 hours after they were supposed to meet at this location. Cora and Cole Twombly told CW that their daughter to clean the truck and that she did not have to worry about Veronica Butler ever again. Now, before that, Cora and Cole actually blocked the road to divert Butler and Kelly to where Adams, Cole, and Grice were. That's when the murder happened. So they were supposed to be at this location where we're live currently. They were then diverted to Adams. That's when the murder takes place. CW also confirmed with the OSBI that an attempt to kill Butler happened in February of 2024 in Hugoton, but Butler did not leave a house. A previous attempt to kill Butler happened back in February of 2024, just months ago. Now, Adams, also through the affidavit, we learned she bought 3 prepaid cell phones from the Walmart on February 13th in Guymon, Oklahoma. All 3 of those phones were pinged in the area where the car was located, then turned off and turned back near a dam 8.5 miles away. They found that dam just 8.5 miles away, as we mentioned, from the location of the cars. The dam had been dug into. They had hay, and that's the last spot those phones were pinged. All of this evidence that we just brought you up from the affidavit is why these 4 arrests were made. These 4 people were charged with murder, among other charges. Now, we were at a press conference earlier this morning. Here's what other law enforcement officials had to say.
From the get-go, once we arrived on scene, that and we gained a little bit of information, that we felt this wasn't a random deal. All right. We felt that with some of the information coming in, that it was more targeted, and we started to look in those areas that we were pointed to.
And now we asked OSBI today as well if they could confirm that those 2 bodies were Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly. They said they still cannot confirm that, but they did.
Well, that's been confirmed now. We know, in fact, that he gave a good sort of summary there, but it's been confirmed now by the Oklahoma Office of the Chief Medical Examiner that those were in fact the bodies of Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly. So we know that. You know, Bobby, I want to just thank you so much for coming on with basically no notice. And you add so much to the show. And I like you pumped up. The women love to see you pumped up. You know, someone in the chat said, oh, but there's three washed up cops. Because we were giving it to YouTubers. Yeah, we're all washed up, bro.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm down in Jupiter, Florida, spending the winter here. That's how washed up I am. Bobby writes for Criminal Minds and writes for TV. Mike's a professor. They have law degrees. We're all washed up because YouTubers are the most successful people, you know? I love that, you know? Some of these people should watch YouTube 24 hours a day. That's
Look, I like YouTube. I have lots of friends in the true crime podcast world. It's not everybody, but there are a few out there that don't stay in their lanes. But there are many of them are my friends. They have good podcasts I listen to. You guys are the only ones I clear the decks for, though, to jump on because I feel like this is family. And you know, you guys know my background and stuff. And so I actually did, I think, turn down something tonight. I forget, somebody wanted something. I did something on the Baltimore Bridge this morning at 4:45 a.m. my time. Wow. 'Cause it was an East Coast morning show. So it was like 7:45 for them on Newsmax. So they had me on.
Bobby, I would have been like, my Venmo is.
Yeah, I only do it. I do it very sparingly that early. Nancy Grace sometimes is around 6:30 my time, but this happened to be 4:30 because it was 7:30 on the East Coast, but they really wanted me. They asked me to do a fair because you know I brought my dive team to the Minneapolis bridge collapse in 2007. So I had my divers in the water on a bridge on the last major bridge collapse. And now the FBI has opened a criminal investigation in Baltimore on that bridge collapse. So we were going over some of the legal theories on the crimes that could result from that Baltimore bridge collapse.
You know, Bobby, what's amazing about that was how quickly our government was ready to just pay for it. How about insurance companies pay for it that a big barge hit this bridge and brought it down? How about they pay for it?
Well, you notice there was a lot of walk back of those initials. We're going to rebuild everything. And then the city of Baltimore and the mayor, the governor of Maryland, like, whoa, wait a minute with all the we're going to rebuild it right away, you know, kind of thing. They've got to find the resources. I mean, that's going to be a very expensive. I mean, normally when they're building bridges, cities and states have to float bond issues and things like that to raise the funds because it's so expensive. You can't put the taxpayers on the hook because where are you going to get the money from? You're either going to raise taxes or you're going to start canceling some other programs. You know, government has limited resources. So yeah, they'll be, but we all know how long civil courts take, right? So civil cases do not get adjudicated very quickly. And so that could be a long time coming before insurance companies stop paying off, you know, and before civil judgments start getting satisfied. So, you know, the government may have to come out of pocket a little bit. And then hopefully, I don't know if they get reimbursed through judgments or whatever. But hopefully they have some emergency funds, but it's going to take a while.
Wow. Someone wrote, I don't know if this is true or not. Pumpkin. I like pumpkin. The judge was asked to resign immediately by the mayor. He did resign. He should resign. If this that guy's a joke, you know.
That's good to know, Pumpkin. That's great information. I like that, and it's good to hear. It's certainly something that ran through my head when I saw that video report.
Yeah, I just couldn't. When I was watching it, I was like, "Does this guy realize what he's saying?" And when he corrected himself, he says, "Oh." I don't mean he was my friend. He is my friend. I was like, oh, my God, Judge. I think maybe you should, get rid of that title.
Show a little more restraint. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mike, your final thoughts.
I just want to say thank you very much for Bobby to come on because you are family, and that's wonderful. So thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
And I just want to say that everyone should just say a prayer for the families of these two ladies and keep them in our prayers because they are suffering so much. So they deserve any prayers we can give them.
100%. Bobby, you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, no, the same thing as Professor Mike. I mean, those two kids, 6 and 8 year old, you know, they're without a mom now. Their dad's not there for them. This is a tough time for a child that age to lose one parent and not have the other parent around. Hopefully they get the support that they need. from other family members and from social services and from the public, because they're the victims here now. I mean, obviously the two victims, my heart goes out to those two victims and their families, but we've got two kids now that are going to have a lot of adjustments made in their lives so that they can have normal lives, if you can even consider it a normal life, when your grandmother kills your mother. So, my thoughts are with those two kids, and hopefully they're getting the support that they need.
Very well said, 100%. And let me just put up there pictures. Rest in peace, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, and we pray for your families and your souls. And this is a horrific case, and brings us right back to what we used to do when we investigated homicides. And my initial monologue for this was that the police, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, all the police agencies that worked on this did an unbelievable job. And you amateur investigators, stay the hell out of their way when they're working. And don't think that your need for information should supersede their need to solve this case. So, folks, thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in. Have a great night from Police Off the Cuff, and God bless everyone. Okay. One episode, just ain't enough.